And again, the trick we used was to, if we start with some potential that has a metastable state, which we called the false vacuum, and there existed a lower energy or a preferred state we called the true vacuum, then we perform this trick where we go to Euclidean time, which gives us this upside down potential. And then with a guess about the symmetry of the solution, we were able to reduce this quantum field theory problem to a problem in one-dimensional quantum mechanics. And there was a classical path we were able to find in this upside down potential, which connected the true vacuum side to this false vacuum minimum, right? So that classical path was just a function of this Euclidean radius. So that was our assumption about the symmetry, that this instanton had rotational symmetry in four-dimensional Euclidean space. And then we, in analogy with the one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem, calculated this rate, which is now a basically a width per unit volume, which if you think about it, the dimensions work out right to interpret this as basically a probability per unit four volume to nucleate a bubble. Okay. So we had a 1 over length in the width and then 1 over volume. Okay, and this depended on a piece which was this basically the functional determinant. So this was fluctuations about the classical path. And then we had a term that had to do with the classical path itself. Okay, so this is our probability per unit four volume. And a rather critical assumption that I'll just bring up again is that we assumed that this O4 invariant instanton dominates the path integral. That is, it is the solution, the classical path, that has the lowest action. Because if there was something with a lower action, I've got this e to the minus s, and then that thing with a lower action would have dominated this decay rate. Okay? So in flat space, one can prove this. There's a paper by Coleman and Glaser, which proved that this O4 invariant instanton is indeed the one with lowest action. So in flat space, we have a solid proof. We know that this is the right solution, and that this is indeed an accurate characterization of the decay probability. And the other thing that this calculation gave us was a real space picture of what happens after this bubble nucleates. Okay, so this rate tells us the amplitude to go from empty flat space to empty flat space with a bubble inside. Okay, and again, in analogy with the one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem, I make a measurement at some time. We'll pick that to be t equals 0, just arbitrarily. We can always put it there by time translation. So we have some time where we make a measurement and we see, aha, there is a bubble there. Okay, and the configuration in this wedge, remember this wedge was just Rindler space. We obtain the field configuration by doing an analytic continuation of rho so that t is now real time. And because phi from the instanton is just a function of rho, then I get phi on all the constant rho surfaces in this Rindler wedge. Okay. As I go out to spatial infinity in this part of the spacetime, I end up at phi f, the false vacuum. And on this light cone, the boundary of Rindler space, which is where rho equals 0, I'm at phi star, which was the point I had to choose in my classical path, such as to end up exactly at phi f at infinity. And then I can do a different analytic continuation to obtain the solution inside of this patch, which you'll recall was Milne, or an open Robertson-Walker universe, okay? Which in fact, if you measure the distance from the center of the bubble, was an infinite open Robertson-Walker universe, okay? So it's by geometry that I'm able to in fact embed this infinite open Robertson-Walker universe inside of the bubble. And if I go to future infinity in this open Robertson-Walker universe, I end up at phi t. So in the Milne patch, I have this rolling of the field from phi star down to phi t. And the last thing we talked about yesterday was this thin wall limit. Okay, the thin wall limit told us that this transition from one side to the other happens basically instantaneously in comparison to the total size of the instanton. So if we were to plot phi as a function of rho, it would look something like this, where this transition from phi star to phi f happens basically instantaneously on the scale of the whole size of the instanton. And in that limit, we can basically characterize the bubble as some wall with a tension sigma, which is located at a position rho equals r naught, where we calculated r naught to be 3 sigma over vf minus vt. Okay, so if I go back to this diagram, the wall is one of these surfaces of constant rho. Say that one. Okay. And since each point in this Penrose diagram is a two-sphere, then this looks like a growing two-sphere, okay? A two-sphere that's growing in size with constant acceleration. So it really does look like a bubble. Okay, so are there any questions on the material that we covered yesterday that either came up yesterday in the tutorial or that you had this morning or yesterday during class? Okay. So today we're going to come back to cosmology. So this exercise was to illustrate the fact that there are these processes in quantum field theory that are non-perturbative, so that we wouldn't have captured just with perturbation theory. And we're going to see how they can be important for cosmology. Well, it should be sort of clear that this is a truly cosmological effect, because once I make one of these bubbles, it just grows without bound. Okay? So you might imagine that this could be relevant for things happening on super large scales. The second clue that this might have something to do with cosmology comes from the geometry of this bubble. So inside the bubble, I have embedded this open Robertson-Walker universe. So a light bulb should go off in your head. Well, we kind of live in an open Robertson-Walker universe, so maybe this could have something to do with our universe as we know it. So to get back to cosmology, first we're going to add one cog to this machine, which is to talk about vacuum decay with gravity. Okay, we wouldn't be able to talk about cosmology without gravity. So we're going to have an action now that includes not only a scalar field, but also the Einstein-Hilbert action. So I can write an arbitrary, canonically normalized scalar field theory. This is the Lorentzian action as this, where R is the four-dimensional Ricci scalar. And we can define a path integral formally, which includes both the scalar field and gravity. So here I'm going to have some propagator between some final configuration, which has to do with phi of x, but also the metric configuration. And formally, again, I have a propagator that tells me how to connect some initial and some final state. And I can express this as an integral over all paths through configuration space that include both the metric and the scalar field times e to the I s over h bar. Okay. So formally, we can write this down. Of course, actually evaluating this path integral now with g mu nu is really hard, and if we had solved that problem, we'd basically have solved the problem of quantum gravity. So formally, this is incredibly difficult to actually do, mostly because it's really difficult to define this measure over all metrics. Okay? There's no unique classification of all four-dimensional manifolds. It just doesn't exist. So what we do, in lieu of actually solving the entire thing, is again to look for saddle points, that is classical paths, g mu nu and phi, which extremize this action. Okay? And once we find these classical paths, then we can look at fluctuations around them. And in a similar spirit to what we did over here, we didn't have to solve the entire path integral to find this rate. We just needed to identify a classical path and have a well-defined way of studying perturbations around it. We're going to do the same thing here. And again, the way to make progress will be to try and turn this into a one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem. So the way that we're going to do that, again, so we're going to work with imaginary time, which again will just have the effect of taking some potential of phi to negative v of phi. Okay? And now we can identify some classical path phi bar, which can connect the two sides of this potential. But now we're going to have something else that comes along for the ride, which is the metric. Okay? So we're going to find the path that includes both the scalar field and the metric. And almost immediately, we get into some fairly deep interpretational issues, right? Because in spirit over here, what we were actually doing is finding the correction to the ground state energy of this quantum field theory. Okay, and we found that it had an imaginary component, and that corresponded to this decay rate. So what I'm telling you we're doing is we're trying to find the ground state of this system and look at the imaginary correction to it. So already in the beginning, at step one, I'm sort of assuming there is an analog of a ground state to gravity. And in fact, we'll talk tomorrow when we do quantum cosmology about a well-defined prescription for that. That's Hartle and Hawking's no boundary proposal for the wave function of the universe. It's basically something like the ground state of gravity. Okay, so that's kind of built in here. We'll do that in a little bit more detail tomorrow. And again, we're going to assume rotational invariance in four-dimensional Euclidean space, okay? Because that worked for flat space, and if I turn on gravity, if that's just a small correction, I shouldn't expect this to really go wrong. I should mention in brief that there is no corresponding proof that this assumption gives me the lowest action solution, but you can construct things that have less symmetry and check. And what you find is that this is the thing that has the lowest action. Okay, so it's less of a proof and more of a series of checks. Okay, but we think this is true. So with this assumption, now the most general metric I can write down in Euclidean space, so we've gone to imaginary time. I've got this coordinate, we'll call it xi. And then I have some scale factor times the metric on a unit 3-sphere. Okay. So this is something that has a closed topology, and then it will just take different shapes. Okay, but I still retain this rotational invariance associated with that 3-sphere. Okay. So I can take this assumption for the metric, and I can now stick it into the action that I have up there, where we're now talking about the Euclidean action. So I've taken v to minus v, and derive an expression. So here I have 2 pi squared. That came from integrating over the angles in this three-sphere. And then I've got rho cubed, that came from the square root g, times phi dot squared over 2 plus v of phi, where dot is now going to be a derivative with respect to xi. And then I've got the gravitational part, which is 3 m Planck squared, rho squared, rho double dot, plus rho, rho dot squared, minus rho. Okay. So this just came from sticking this metric into the Ricci scalar, okay, and doing that calculation. So finding the Christoffel components and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, okay, so here's our action. And now you can see that we have an action for a one-dimensional system. Okay, it only depends on xi. But we have 2 variables. We've got phi and we've got rho. Okay. So the difference between the flat space case now is we've just added this other variable, the metric. And if we vary this action, we get a set of equations of motion. So we'll get a field equation. This looks like 3 rho dot over rho phi dot. So again, I have this sort of friction term in my equation of motion for phi equals v prime. And in addition to the field equation, I also have the Friedmann equation, effectively, right? Because think about it, this is basically a Euclidean version of a closed Robertson-Walker metric. Okay? So the equation of motion I should get looks effectively like the Friedmann equation for a closed universe. So I get rho dot squared is 1 plus rho squared over 3 and Planck squared, 1 half phi dot squared minus v. Again, the Euclidean part comes in taking v to minus v. So instead of plus v, I got minus v here. And then we also have an auxiliary Friedmann equation we could find by taking the time derivative of this and sticking in the equation of motion for the field. And that's also going to be useful for us. So we'll write it down. This one is rho double dot equals minus rho over 3 m Planck squared, phi dot squared plus v. So here's our action. Here's our equations of motion. And now let's try and find an analog of that bounce. So we have our potential. One thing I should mention is that now we're talking about gravity. The zero of the potential very much matters, right? So I'm not free to arbitrarily push this well up and down and zero the energy of the false vacuum, because the energy of a scalar field gravitates. Okay, so this is a different case. If I start moving this potential around, it really matters. Okay. So in general, we've got something where phi f and phi t have a distinct vacuum energy associated with them. Okay. And the type of solution we're looking for, so we want to find phi bar and rho bar, the classical path for the Euclidean potential that connects one side to the other. And we find this solution by imposing a set of boundary conditions. So at c equals 0, we're going to set rho equals 0. Okay, that just corresponds to looking at, this is a closed universe, so we need to figure out what happens at the poles of this 3-sphere. Okay. So this is like the origin of coordinates. So at c equals 0, we set rho equals 0. And you'll see something immediately, which here I need to specify a time derivative of rho, so I need to tell you exactly how rho goes to 0. And that comes from the first Friedmann equation. So if none of these terms diverge as rho goes to 0, rho dot equals 1. So from this, it follows that rho dot equals 1 at c equals 0. That just came from the Friedmann equation and requiring that the energy density of the scalar field doesn't diverge as rho goes to 0. So with these two conditions, we can see there's a further condition, which is that in this equation of motion, it had better be true that phi dot also goes to 0 as rho goes to 0. Yeah? Otherwise, I get 1 over 0 times finite, and then this thing blows up. So we also know that phi dot at c equals 0 equals 0. Okay. So we've got an initial condition for rho, rho dot, phi dot. I still need an initial condition for phi. And just like before, that's the thing that we're going to tune in order to find a solution. So I want to figure out the equivalent of phi star for the flat space case, right? So we still need phi star, which is defined as phi at c equals 0. Okay, so let's think a little bit about what would happen if I just picked an arbitrary position, phi star. So again, we'll turn the potential upside down. We've got something that looks like this, where this is phi f and this is phi t. And I'll pick some arbitrary starting point, phi star. So as a function of xi, we can write rho and phi. So at xi equals 0, I start here at phi star. Okay. And rho starts at 0. So initially, rho dot is 1, so it looks kind of like that. And let's think about what happens given the equations of motion. So if I start down here, for this particular example I chose, v is negative, and phi dot is small because I started from rest. So initially, rho double dot is positive. Okay, so rho is accelerating. And now phi is going to start rolling down the hill, which corresponds to positive v. And everywhere after I cross 0, v is positive. Yeah. So I have v positive and phi dot squared. And that means rho double dot has to get negative. So eventually, rho has to turn around. It's going to go from accelerating to decelerating. And it's going to keep decelerating. And that means that eventually, rho is going to hit 0 again. So there's some xi, we'll call it xi max, where rho, again, equals 0. Now, of course, as this is happening, the field, as I said, has rolled down. It's approaching the other side. And we needed to stop. Okay, so we needed to end up somewhere. Actually, it's much more imperative that the thing stops, because if I look at the equation of motion, rho is going back to 0. Okay? Furthermore, rho dot has changed sign. So while I started here with friction, as soon as rho turns around, I get anti-friction. Okay. Because the sign of that term has changed. So now I'm getting shot up the hill. And I'm going to get shot harder and harder as rho goes to zero. So it had better be true that by the time I get to Cmax, phi dot is zero. Otherwise, I just get shot arbitrarily hard, and I diverge. I just run off to infinity. So the solution I'm looking for is one where I've chosen phi star in such a way that I end up with phi dot equals zero when the scale factor goes back to zero. And that, because, again, this is a finite range, I turn around and I come back to zero. Since it's a finite range, I'm not going to end up exactly at phi f, right? It would take me an infinite amount of time to get up there. So instead, I end somewhere else. We'll call it phi star 2. Okay, and this is the type of solution that we're looking for that is going to satisfy these boundary conditions, solve the equations of motion, and be non-singular, right? So there's no divergence of the energy density associated with the scalar field anywhere. And there's going to be one solution that does this. So there's going to be one solution that makes it back and forth exactly once. And that's going to be our bounce. So this thing is our bounce, or instanton, okay? And because of the authors of the paper that introduced this, this is known as the Kalman-DeLucia instanton. So this is the type of solution we want to this one-dimensional problem. And again, in analogy with the flat space case, we're going to port over the answer for the rate from one-dimensional quantum mechanics. So before we get there, are there any questions about this solution? So it's just like the flat space case where we're trying to dial that initial condition just right to get a solution that ends up exactly at phi dot equals zero when the scale factor goes to zero. Okay. Yep. No, because I'm not going all the way up to phi f anymore. So if I was going all the way to the top of the hill, I would have to just keep decelerating for an infinite amount of time till I get to the top. But now, since we've lowered our ambition level, if you will, and I just need to get somewhere near phi f, then it just takes a finite amount of time. Okay, so now there's actually another solution. This is an easy one. So if I have my upside down potential, I could just sit here at phi f. Okay? So there's no dynamics in the field. But rho will have dynamics. So let's look at the Friedman equation, right? If phi dot squared is zero, because I'm just sitting at the top of the hill, then I just have rho double dot equals minus rho over 3 and Planck squared times v. And V is just V evaluated at phi F. Okay, so it's just a constant. Did you have a question? Yeah, maybe that's a poor choice of notation. Let's call it phi star 2. And we'll call the other one phi star 1 to remove that ambiguity. Okay, so we're over here. We're solving the second Friedman equation. And this is just the equation of motion for a harmonic oscillator, right? Rho double dot equals negative constant times rho. So with the solution that we had before, which is that rho x equals 0 is 0, and rho dot x equals 0 is 1, then the solution to this differential equation is simply rho equals square root of 3 m Planck squared over v evaluated at phi f times sine v at phi f over 3 m Planck squared times xi. Okay. So this is another solution. This one is the analog of the harmonic oscillator solution that we had in the one-dimensional quantum mechanics case, right? Except for now, because there's another variable, the scale factor, that comes along for the ride, there's a non-trivial variation, and there's a non-trivial action. So I could stick this solution. This is sort of another classical path that I might care about, and it's going to have finite action. Okay, so we've got these two classical paths that we've identified, the bounce, which connects the two wells, and this one, which just kind of sits at the top of the false vacuum. And again, in analogy with one-dimensional quantum mechanics, we just stick in these classical paths to the action, and we calculate a rate given by that formula we had over there. So this, again, is some prefactor times e to the minus the Euclidean action evaluated at this classical path that connects the two wells over h bar, where now this Euclidean action has got to include both this guy that sits at the top, because it now has non-zero action, and the bounce. So we have these two saddle points that we care about. We'll call the first one SI. Okay, that's the Euclidean action evaluated for the bounce solution. And we'll call the other one BG for background. Okay, that's phi bar just sitting at the false vacuum. Okay, so the SBG is easy to evaluate. So I just have rho and V, and phi dot equals 0. So I stick that in that form of the action up there, and I simplify. And what you'll find is that this equals negative 24 pi squared times m Planck to the fourth power over v evaluated at phi f. Okay, so that's the action of this saddle point. You'll notice that it's negative, and that came from the fact that the gravitational action is negative, okay, and the sign's important. So this guy is negative for that reason. And SI is just something I have to evaluate. Okay, so SI for the bounce uh, equals some complicated expression that you need to evaluate. Okay? But it's straightforward. I just literally take this solution that I found and I stick it in to that Euclidean action. Okay, another word is that this is also less than zero. And again, that comes from the gravitational contribution, so this is also going to be negative. And if I'm going to have a rate that is less than one, so if I have a probability per unit volume that's less than one, it had better be true that the thing in the exponential itself is negative, right? So I have to have e to the minus something. And that requires that the magnitude of this background subtraction is bigger than the magnitude of the instanton action. So that's more or less a requirement for this to even make sense. And indeed, that's borne out by any example that you could try. Okay. So there's also the prefactor. And if you guys want to write a paper that's never been written before, you can write a paper on how to compute the prefactor A in a theory with gravity, because that hasn't really been done in detail before. So prefactor A, hard to evaluate. Nevertheless, all you really need to do is expand the action to second order in a closed universe and calculate the functional determinant.
Okay, well, could you explain again why you subtract the two options?
Yeah, so that subtraction came about for a somewhat technical detail. So remember in the computation of the one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem, we had a fudge factor times the determinant for the harmonic oscillator, and then we set that equal to this functional determinant for the thing with the actual potential. In this expression, there's now a e to the minus s. This really, remember, was v double prime evaluated at phi f. So there's another guy here that came along for the ride. And in solving for k, I have to invert it, and then it gets stuck back at the top. The reason we didn't have this in the one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem is because when we're not considering gravity, you can always zero the potential wherever you want. So we just set that to zero, and we never cared about it. But now we have to care. OK, so. Yeah, there's this prefactor. That's hard. We don't know how to do that. And then the thing that we can do is to figure out the post-tunneling configuration. Okay. Again, we can do this by using the fact that we have this assumed symmetry, and we have this Euclidean metric. And if I analytically continue the coordinates in the right way, then I can figure out the field configuration in Lorentzian space after this thing has nucleated. So again, let's just write out that Euclidean metric. This is d xi squared plus rho squared of xi times the metric on a unit 3 sphere, which we can write out. So that's d theta 1 sine theta 1. D theta 2 squared and d theta 3. Okay. So that's the metric on a unit 3 sphere. And again, we can take theta 1 goes to I theta 1 to get the region that describes basically what is the wall. So let me now draw the Penrose diagram for this case. Okay. And actually, I'll put it over here because we might need it later. And I'll draw it real big. Okay, so we have to pick some time. Okay, so we're going to study this potential where here I have phi f, and actually, for convenience, why don't we do the case where phi t is also positive? Okay, so both v at phi f and v at phi t are positive. So if I sat here at phi f for all time, I have a positive vacuum energy and I would just get De Sitter space. Yeah. So here is the bottom half of the Penrose diagram for De Sitter space, where both on the left vertical and the right vertical row is zero. Okay. So this is the place where the closed universe has its poles. And the region that I cover by doing this analytic continuation, so this is theta 1 goes to I theta 1. And actually, I think to get it right, we need a pi over 2. Otherwise, we get a cinch here instead of a cosh. So I have this, which tells me about what happens in this part of space-time, where here I have rho equals 0 and phi equals phi star 1. And on the other side, again, I have rho equals 0 and phi equals phi star 2. So I had these two important places, which were the right boundary conditions to give me this non-singular solution, phi star 1 and phi star 2. And then I can perform a different continuation in here, which is to take c goes to I c and theta 1 goes to I theta 1. And this is going to correspond on this side to the field rolling down to phi t. And again, in here, I get this open Robertson-Walker universe. So here what I'm saying is that because of the gravitational contribution to the action, mm-hmm. both S background and SI are negative. So it had better be true if that's the way I define SE, the thing that's sitting in the exponential, that the magnitude of SBG has to be bigger than the magnitude of SI.
Okay, two things. But shouldn't it depend on A?
A is?
The prefactor.
Yeah, good. So I guess I'm assuming that A itself, yeah, that's good. So I suppose here a necessary condition, but maybe not a sufficient condition, would be for that exponential to be less than 1. You're right, you have to care about the prefactor too, because if that was huge, then you could drive this to be a number bigger than 1. But let's assume that that's not true. And a necessary condition would be that the exponential itself has to be e to the minus something. I guess that
makes sense. Okay, but by this condition, it would be e to the something positive, right? Because SE would be negative, like if this background is bigger than SI, then SD would be negative, and negative would be positive, so it would be E to a positive.
Good, but you're missing one negative sign, because both SBG and SI are negative. Okay. So I've got SE,
okay, right.
Okay, but that's, there's a lot of negative signs, so let's just rewrite it. So this is really magnitude SVG minus magnitude SI, if they're both negative. And then SE is positive for, this is greater than zero for SVG bigger than SI. Okay, so we're back at this Penrose diagram. Again, to get this region in here, I do this analytic continuation. This is the analog in flat space of the Rindler wedge, right? Where the constant rho looks something like this. And then in here, I have the analog of that open Robertson-Walker or Milne patch in the Minkowski case. And the surface of constant rho looks something like this, where at rho equals zero, phi equals phi star one. And then on the other side where rho equals zero, phi equals phi star two. And I should mention that when we get up to the top, we get to phi t, because I'm rolling back to phi t on that side. And on the other side, we roll back to phi f. If only I was 3 inches taller, I could draw that straight. So that's supposed to be straight on top. So here's the picture. This is the space-time picture. I have this surface where the bubble nucleates. And then I get this field configuration. But it's a little bit bizarre. It's a little bit different than the Minkowski case. Because rho goes to zero at two places. So there's in fact two origins for spherical symmetry in the Lorentzian solution. So if I'm sitting over here, I think I'm inside a bubble that's rolling back to phi f, because that's the center of spherical symmetry. While if I'm over here, I think I'm inside a bubble rolling back to phi t. So in fact, this instanton corresponds to the formation, if you will, almost of two bubbles, because there's two centers of spherical symmetry. That's an oddity of the geometry. So that's how we get the post-tunneling configuration. I form this bubble. Another thing to note is that I never eat up all of the false vacuum when I form one bubble. Right? There's always this place that I could go to where the field rolls back to phi f. So if I'm sitting here, I've really got a choice. I could go this way and end up in phi f, or I could go this way and end up in phi t. So this is a geometry that basically interpolates between, on one side, the false vacuum, and on the other side, the true. And they both coexist on constant time slices in a sort of closed slicing, right? Okay, so that's bubbles with gravity. And now in the last 10 minutes or so, we're going to go back to the concept of eternal inflation. So this is one bubble. But in fact, there's going to be more than one. So if I start in some space-time, there's this probability per unit pore volume to form bubbles. And surely, if that probability is bigger than zero, it's not going to happen just one place, but it's going to happen at a number of places. So we're going to try and construct a picture that takes that into account in a sort of coarse-grained way. So here, basically, what we're just doing is saying, well, what about more than one bubble? So in describing this, it's going to be useful to go to the thin wall limit again, so that I actually have something that looks like you know, some spherical membrane that carries some tension, and it's really localized at a specific place. As opposed to the most general thing, where you can see the wall, or the region where this field goes from phi t to phi f, is spread out over all of space-time. Okay, so we're in the thin wall limit. And you'll recall that a way of viewing De Sitter space, this was the first tutorial in the first homework, is to look at a hyperboloid in this five-dimensional Minkowski space. Okay? So this is De Sitter. And De Sitter has basically certainly it has the five-dimensional we don't want to do Euclidean De Sitter. So we want to do five-dimensional De Sitter space, which has this 0-4-1 symmetry. That is, it's got rotations and boosts in five-dimensional Minkowski space. Yeah. And the De Sitter with a bubble is going to have 0-3-1 symmetry, okay? That basically just means before we were assuming we had 0-4 symmetry, and when I do this analytic continuation, one of those rotations turns into a boost. Another way of understanding this, well, this is really just a fancy way of writing something that has spherical symmetry and constant acceleration. And a spherical membrane filled with vacuum energy will expand with constant acceleration. Okay, so this bubble solution has this 0-3-1 symmetry. So to get to De Sitter with a bubble from De Sitter, I have to break one of these rotational invariances that I had in the full De Sitter solution. So let's call, actually it's important that I call this direction x4. Basically, if I introduce a plane into five-dimensional Minkowski space, then I'll break one of these rotational symmetries. And if I put this plane at constant x4, and I drew that trajectory, the intersection of the plane with this hyperbola, it would trace out one of these surfaces of constant rho. So we could identify one of these surfaces, just like we did in Minkowski space, as the wall. So this is just a simple geometrical picture to get us there without having to do anything terribly complicated. And you'll recall that we had these embedding space picture for how to get the different coordinates in De Sitter space. And for the static patch, x4 was given by H inverse 1 minus HR. And if we look at t equals 0, then this is just given by HF inverse 1 minus HF squared R naught squared. T equals 0 in the static patch is just my arbitrary choice for the nucleation surface. So this is in the static patch. And this just tells me what constant I should assign to x4. Okay? So it tells me where I should put this plane in the five-dimensional Minkowski space. It just has to do with the initial radius of the bubble. And this, I know, is related to also whatever other coordinate system I want to use in de Sitter space. So let's say I want to use the flat slicing, for example. This is HF inverse cosh HFT minus HF over 2 R squared e to the HFT. By setting this side equal to that side, I can now solve for R. So in the flat slicing, we can find the trajectory of this wall. It's just 1 plus e to the minus 2 HFT minus square root 1 minus R naught squared HF squared e to the minus HFT. So this is the trajectory of the wall in the flat slicing. Let's draw a picture so it's clear what I mean. So here again is the Penrose diagram for de Sitter space. Recall that the flat slicing describes this upper piece. And I'm looking at one of these surfaces of constant rho. This again is rho equals R naught, just the position of this thin wall. So indeed, this looks like an expanding bubble in this background. And this equation tells me how the flat slicing position R varies with flat slicing time on this diagram. So this is equivalent to R of t. And the thing to note is that as t goes to infinity, R just goes to HF inverse. Okay, so these bubbles at late times just approach a constant co-moving size. So if I were to take this and rewrite it and draw a different picture, let's just plot a slice through R and T, the flat slicing R and T. So I suppose I should have reminded you that the flat slicing metric is just this. And if I make a plot of R and T, then the formation of one of these bubbles would look something like this. So I start here, the bubble has sort of zero size, and then it grows, but it approaches a constant co-moving size, roughly of HF inverse. So if I have other bubbles, then they're going to deform and then reach some constant co-moving size. But the size that they reach is going to depend on the time that they form. Because here, I assume that the bubble formed at t equals 0. Yeah. So if the bubble forms at some later time, its asymptotic size is going to be the co-moving horizon size. So I have a factor of 1 over a. So as I make more and more bubbles on this plot, the bubbles get smaller and smaller. And so if the rate of forming these bubbles is small enough, you can see that I have to compete against the fact that these bubbles themselves are becoming smaller. And again, I could get to a situation where I have eternal inflation. So I'm not removing volume from phi f fast enough to keep up with the expansion of phi f itself. So that's basically where we're going to get. Unfortunately, I'm out of time for today. So tomorrow at the beginning of class, we'll derive a formula that tells me exactly how to cut out pieces of the false vacuum and fill them with true. And then from that, we'll be able to see how this phenomenon of eternal inflation arises. Okay. So just to recap, we started with vacuum decay in quantum field theory. That told us how to make bubbles in flat space. We're interested in doing cosmology, so that means we need to understand how bubbles form in the presence of gravity. Okay. And the main result was this calculation of the rate. So this told us how often this will occur. Okay. And then we had this space-time picture of what happens after these bubbles nucleate, where the important points were that one bubble never eats up all of the false vacuum, if the false vacuum has a positive energy. And then what we'll do tomorrow is see how, when I have many bubbles, it can become impossible to completely eat up the false vacuum, even with an arbitrary number of bubbles, okay? Because it's hard for the removal of volume to keep up with the expansion of the background. So are there any questions before we break for the day?
Not being able to eat up the false vacuum.
Yeah, so here I have this Penrose diagram. And if I had a Penrose diagram for de Sitter without any bubble in it, it would just look like this, where everywhere I'm in phi f. So all I've done is I've removed, by forming this bubble, effectively I've removed this part from phi f. But up here, the radius of two spheres goes to infinity, so there's still an infinite amount of volume in phi f that remains. So by forming this bubble, I have removed an infinite amount of volume from the false vacuum, but there's still an infinite amount of volume left. In other words, one bubble can't keep up with the expansion of space itself. There's always going to be more somewhere else. Any other questions? Okay, see you guys tomorrow.